You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Hello, and welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations podcast from beautiful Los Angeles, California. I'm Peter Banifaz, and I was the guest on the last episode, but today I'm the host! And my guest today is none other than Mr. John Mackey, who improv fans might know from Winslow.
True.
From Big Grande.
True.
My man is an incredible director, writer.
Yeah.
And an even better person. Again, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Mackey.
That is a very sweet introduction, Pete. I like to think that all the things you said are true.
All of them.
Specifically the ones about the improv teams I'm on, those are definitely true. The more subjective takes that you had on my directing skill, I also hope that's true.
No, it's very true.
Hey, thank you.
I've already talked to the proper people, and I've got confirmation that this guy knows what he's doing.
Oh, cool. You talked to the, I don't even know who the proper people would be.
The head of CBS, so Les
Moonves. Les Moonves says that I'm a great director. Yeah. Fantastic. Thanks, Les.
Yeah. If you're listening, Les, thank you so much.
If you're listening, wow. Wow. Yeah, your busy schedule. You're listening to this. That's great.
So, John, I'm going to just quickly want to find out exactly how you got into comedy.
Okay.
And then maybe pick your brain a little bit and see if our folks out there could maybe, you know, find out how you look at some of these concepts.
Great.
And see if they can open some doors into understanding it for themselves.
That sounds
so
beautiful,
my
Pete.
Man. So you
my man.
So you've been in LA for how long?
I moved here in the summer of 2008, so nice. It'll be 10 years this summer, which is wild.
Wow.
I moved here from North Carolina, went to school there. Didn't do comedy in college. I was a music guy. I was like, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to school just because my parents are requiring it. I was like, when I get done with school, I'm going to start touring with my band. I'm going to be a huge rock star. I'm going to record music, and that's going to be what my life is. I'm never going to have health insurance. I'm never going to be able to pay any of my bills. I'm just going to play music. But that's not what happened.
No. I know. I haven't seen you perform any music ever?
I still play.
Yeah, no.
But my passion is different. My passion has changed. But yeah, I moved out here summer of 2008. And then that fall, so like September of that year, a friend of mine had been taking UCB classes because he'd been out here for a little bit longer than me. He was taking 101. And I had like moved out here with a bunch of college friends, and I had met like no one who was not a person I went to college with. So I was like, I need to sort of expand my sort of social group. And I started taking 101 here at UCB. And that was my first experience in like sort of producing anything with the intent of being funny. I had always like made like weird shorts and stuff as a kid. Like we had like a VHS camcorder that we would steal from my neighbor every weekend. And like we like made stuff, but we didn't know what we were doing. I don't think you could say the intent was to be funny, but it just was not funny because we were just like children who didn't know what to do. When I started taking improv at UCB, that was like my sort of first foray into trying to be funny. Not trying to be funny. We don't try to be funny.
Right.
We don't. That's the big secret. We're up there not trying to be funny.
No, I do.
Yeah,
but
of course.
You don't.
No.
To you just comes.
Yeah, it just comes naturally to me. Me just talking is fun.
When you were no, I agree. When you were young though, did people tell you you're funny? Like
yeah.
You got something.
Like, I was like, I don't have any like sort of super clear memories of this moment, but I've been told that as a toddler, like I would, I figured out that people thought it was funny when I put a, like an inflatable ball that you'd get out of one of those tall towers of like balls at like Walmart that are like big, squishy, like bouncy, big balls. I would put one under my shirt and I would walk into like the family room at like family events and just act like I was pregnant. And everybody thought it was funny. And there's one picture of me that I've seen. I think my grandma had it or my aunt or something. And it's me in like a Mickey Mouse shirt with a big ball under my stomach, just like cheesing at the camera, like the stupidest little kid smile. Like, I know this is so funny. That's probably the first funny Mackie moment of my life. And then, you know, from there as a kid, I was really into like professional wrestling. So that wasn't like necessarily comedy, but like we would make professional, like we would make backyard wrestling videos.
Performance oriented. Yeah. Though, like music, comedy, like you clearly like you were a performer.
Yeah.
You
I think performing has always been like super like in the forefront of who I am, like being the center of attention, people staring at me being the reason people came to see something. Those are all things I really care about. No, but you know, I've always been the kind of person who like needs like that, like needs other people to like sort of look at me, and for better or worse.
Right, and I mean, like, I feel it's almost like the root of all of us is to that extent. But it's like it's not as shallow as that. It's more like the enjoyment of making people feel good, and then what it's you like, get back from that.
I think it's like the immediate information that you receive that someone's enjoying something.
Yes.
Like, I think that that's like the rush that you get doing an improv scene is like that feeling of like, oh, hell yeah, I like made these people have a nicer day. And I think that's something I've always sought out, like even just socially, like at parties or whatever in college. Like, I was always like the person who was like trying to like make sure everybody was like enjoying themselves. And like, I think I've always had like a good sense of humor, but I never really thought of it as something that I could sort of like hang my hat on as like what I am or who I am until I came out here and started studying improv and started studying comedy and started to realize that like, oh wait, maybe like that impulse that I've had my whole life to like make people like to entertain people is really the thing that I should be spending my time doing and like focusing on.
Right.
And I think coming to UCB and meeting so many cool people, it was kind of just like all these things sort of pointing towards like, oh, no, all this other shit you've been doing your whole life. Like music's great, but you're never going to make money. You're never going to make money playing music. Comedy's great. You're also never going to make money doing comedy. But at least there is this like immediacy to comedy, and especially doing comedy at UCB. I think that I couldn't find playing music where I was going on tour with a band and there was like two people in the audience in Eugene, Oregon or whatever. And it's like, that's like so demoralizing. But doing improv in particular, there are at least six or seven other people on stage who are enjoying what you're doing with you.
Right.
You never have that feeling of like dread of like, I'm putting so much into something and no one's having fun.
Yeah.
Because there's always someone else there who's like looking at you and being like, no, I'm having fun with you. And I think that's like the thing that originally really drew me to improv and UCB in particular, is it felt so much like a group thing. Nobody was doing it to be the star. I think that's always something you run into with music too, of like one guy's going to get the attention. The dude who's singing is going to get the attention.
And the guy in the drums is like the people who are drummers in the audience go, man, that guy can wail.
Yeah. It's a much more like spotlighty business. Whereas improv is very much like everybody gets a piece,
right,
and everybody's having fun. And it's like that like support was something that I'd found with friends and stuff previously, but I think really coming to UCB and really diving into the community here, it sort of solidified that as like the thing that I want to like pursue for the rest of my life. Like that feeling of like, oh man, isn't this crazy that we're all doing this stupid, weird thing together? And that was like immediate starting UCB, like my first 101 class. I'm like still friends with multiple people from my first 101 that I like have seen sort of come up through the ranks with me.
That's awesome.
Here. And it's dope.
That's awesome.
It's so dope,
It's so dope, dude. So, dude, let me ask you a question, dude. About what time do you feel like you started really picking up the concepts and, like, you felt like you could, you confident that you understood game and, like, basically on that level where you could get on a Herald team or you were already on a Herald team or ready to audition, like, how long did it take for you?
I think, like, I kind of look at improv as, like, a batting average situation. And I think that I had a shitty batting average at improv until I was on Herald Night. Mm. And I think that that's the way, because even the best improvisers do shitty improv. Like, that's the thing that, like, I think was, there's this, like, sort of pinnacle that you see as, like, an improv student of just, like, I want to get to the point that I get into a scene and it's always perfect and everything's great. And I don't think that ever happens. It still doesn't happen. I've still never had a show where I feel 100% great about everything I did or everything we did as a team.
Likewise.
But, like, there was a time, I think it was after I'd been on Herald Night, where I started to feel like I was successful enough and had a high enough batting average that I belonged there. You know what I mean? Like, even when I first got on Herald Night, I was not expecting to. I was like, I would do good shows, and I always, in my brain, was just like, oh, that's because my scene partner was so good, and they mm-hmm. did so great. Like, even the audition that I did to get on Herald Night, I had that feeling of just like, man, I'm not going to get on a team, but my scene partner in my scenes is definitely going to get on a team. And that was like, I think that just comes down to, like, weird confidence things, where you just, like, you can't judge yourself objectively. And the scene was great, so I was attributing it to someone else. But then, like, I think a few years into Herald Night, like, the first year on Herald Night, like, Winslow, I was my first and only Herald team. And, like, our first year, I think we were also new at it, that, like, it felt like we were, like, really just, like, throwing our elbows in every show. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't feel like we were, like, really hunkering down and, like, doing, like, good Heralds or good improv. It was just, like, 8 funny people who were just, like, on stage, like, flailing, and, like, every, like, 5th show we would, like, get off stage and be like, that was pretty good. And then slowly over time, I think we all kind of had these little moments of just, like, realizing, like, where we were sort of veering off course and, like, kind of course corrected to where, like, I think our, like, second and third years on Herald Night were a lot better. And then I think we had one more. I can't remember if it was 3 or 4 years we were on Herald Night, but I think it was probably, like, in, like, second year on Herald Night was where I really started to think, like, oh, okay, no, I am a good improviser.
Right.
This isn't an accident that I'm here. I'm good at what I do. And I was feeling like I was doing consistently decent to good improv.
When you first got on, like, other than sort of, like, the challenge of doing this as a team, what were some of, like, your personal challenges in the beginning, you feel like? Like, what concepts did you sort of struggle with?
The biggest thing for me, and I got this note from the moment I started doing improv into Herald Night, was that I talk too much. Mm-hmm. I, like, over-explain. I give people way too much to ever deal with, and that was something that was really difficult for me to break. Like, I used to, in my first ever practice group, would constantly get the note, like, John, shut up. Like, you are an insane character in this scene. Be insane once and then shut up. Like, don't just, like, motor mouth through 1,000 different weird things because you're giving your scene partner too much to react to. And I think that that was something that really took a long time for me to, like, break myself of, because I think when I was first starting at improv, I was very much, like, if we're talking, like, the, like, Pirate Ninja Robot, like, trilogy, whatever you want to call it. Not a trilogy. What's, like, the trichotomy? Like, the 3 different things.
The improv trinity.
Character trinity or whatever. I was very much a pirate. I was just, like, I stepped out on stage. I was the first person in every scene. Like, I was like the first person in every show to step out. I was initiating the first scene. I was, like, just going and, like, going. And I think that I got ingrained into my head that, like, I'm the person who just goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was something that took a long time for me to curb. And I think the thing that made me sort of tweak that or like change my approach in any way was putting myself in situations playing with people who were more of that than me and better at that than me, who could do that and make sense and could do that and not like just like shit out of their mouth for 2.5 minutes at the beginning of a scene. You know what I mean? And seeing that other people, how other people could do that successfully, like sort of made me kind of turn the dial down a little bit and examine sort of myself a little bit instead of just being go, 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 go. I started being a little bit more reactive instead of being constantly proactive as an improviser. And I think that realization that like there's just as much worth in reacting to people as there is in providing the stimulus was a thing that changed my approach to improv completely. And I think it's much more of who I am as a player now versus who I was 8 years ago or whenever, 9 years ago when I started. Yeah, I don't know that there was ever a switch that flipped to change. It was just, I think, a slow realization of getting that note constantly of just like, John, you're talking too much, and trying to figure out like why I was doing that. And I think it was probably what it boiled down to was just like nerves and fear, like fear of being the least funny person on stage.
Sure. Which I feel like is a fear most of us have. Like when you're playing with such funny, talented people, can't help but feel like I want to pull my weight.
Yeah.
I don't want to disappoint these other people my peers who I really respect. So, but yeah, it's funny. Others never judge us as hard as we judge ourselves.
At all. Yeah. And I think that's the thing that I've realized too, beyond that of my sort of own personal judgment, is like the idea that like 8 people who play the same way are boring. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
And like trying to be this person who I'm seeing who's getting insane laughs and is like so good at the thing I want to be good at. Trying to be that I'm never going to be successful at that. The only thing I'm going to be successful at is the thing that I can do well.
Right.
And you can always work to get better at these other things, but I think it's like important to like examine how you're playing, why you're playing that way. And like actively try to better yourself, I think. And I think that came in me, it came from playing with the people on Winslow and like other people who I ended up playing a lot with, like Dan Lippert, Drew Tarver, like those guys
right.
who are better at certain aspects of improv than I will ever be. And like seeing them and realizing that I'm not either of them. I need to be the thing that I'm good at.
Right.
Instead of trying to play like somebody else.
And that what makes you so great. Because there's no one that can do exactly the thing you do.
Yeah.
And then like remembering that. Yeah. And that's something I do with myself. So that I completely can see that. Let's say breaking down the Herald a little bit. Break it down. So my main man with a game plan. When it comes to, let's say, the opening, because personally for me, when I first started really doing the Herald, pulling premise was hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So if let's say someone's doing a monologue and you're hearing a monologue, what is one of a good. How should I say? Like, what is a suggestion you have regarding like how to sort of approach pulling a funny premise out of sort of an opening?
I think for me, it's just constantly asking myself why something's funny, right? Like, I think that's like a lot of people, and in coaching, I run into this a lot with people I coach, of like you know that something is funny, but you can't articulate to yourself why you think it's funny,
right?
And I think that like for me in like when Winslow was on Herald Night, we did a pattern game, but we did like a very like living roomy pattern game where it was a lot of like free association and stuff. But then we would also like riff on ideas to sort of like distill them and sort of strip away like any sort of excess like bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was like really beneficial for me in terms of how to pull premise, because it like forced all of us to take an idea that was like this sort of weird amorphous thing and then like slowly shave away at it together until in the end we basically just could say a sculptor who only sculpts his own shit, you know, like, or like his own shits, like
classic.
Like, yeah, that's a stupid example, but you know what I mean. It's like, I don't think that's funny, by the way. I don't think that the words I just said are funny. I wouldn't initiate this scene, but for example's sake, like, you know what I mean. But it's like if somebody just said like a sculptor who like sculpts weird stuff, like that's like. I feel like that's the most broad version of that idea.
Right,
and like,
right.
Like what Winslow would do with that, it's like when we would get that sort of broad version, we would pitch on that and then like sort of yes and each other's ideas until we distilled it down into like the funniest version that we all thought was funny.
Right.
And that helped a lot because we kind of would sometimes, when we were successful, we would leave our opening with a very clear idea of what our three beats were going to be. Because we had done that work already. And I think that like the flip side of that coin with our opening in particular used to be, for me anyway, we would get so specific with some of our ideas that when someone initiated something that didn't like one-to-one feel like the thing that we had talked about in the opening,
right.
It would totally fuck me up. Like I would get so in my head because it would be like that thing of just like, oh shit, we were looking at this completely differently in the opening and now I don't know what you want from me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always a challenge for me when it felt like there was like a disconnect between what I had gotten from something in the opening and what someone else had gotten from the opening.
Right.
And that came down to us getting to these like super specific, like weird ideas and having that weird expectation of like, oh, I know what that scene's going to be. And then when it's not that, that shock of like, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have that moment at the top of the scene where you're like, fuck, I don't know if this is that. Is this that? Yeah, it's that. Okay. But then your scene's already fucked.
Right.
Like, if you have that moment of like, instead of just like diving in, just being like, is this the thing? Fuck. That's already too long. Like, you're already past...
And if it's like a weird, let's say it's like a weird idea, like you said, like a very specific idea.
A weird idea, like a sculptor who like only sculpts his own shits.
Right. So like, and then, so, just like classic weird ass idea of like someone who, let's say, sculpts his own poo. So would you initiate, and if you're initiating that scene, what would be your approach to initiating? Like, are you going to try to initiate that as the most simple, most human way? Do you lean into sort of the weirdness?
I think, in particular, I'm like big on base reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a thing that gets lost so much in a lot of like indie improv that
I
see.
Right.
People come in with just blurting out the unusual thing. Like the initiation is just like, here's what's weird about me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that can be so hard because then you have to like sort of like retrofit a scene to this unusual thing. Yeah. So for me as an improviser, I tend to try to initiate a very like clean base reality. And hope that the confidence with which I initiate that scene in a more neutral based reality will like let my scene partner know that like I've got this under control, just bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And like just yes and the world for me, like let's get something going so that we feel like this is a real place, and then I'll initiate
the actual premise
because I think that like for me it's not funny to me if there's not a real sort of context for
it,
right? Like I want to see like what kind of sculptor that guy is. Like I want to see him before I know what's weird about him, because I want to know why it's weird,
right?
Like if he's just like a dude who's like, hey, what's up, man? I sculpted this shit for you. It's like, okay, whatever. But if I initiate like at a high end art gallery, be like, I'm so excited to show everyone my piece. Thank you for coming to the opening today. You've all obviously got your wine and cheese. This is going to be beautiful. This piece took me a very long time, and I really do think you're all going to love it. And the bidding war will start, and then I show you this sculpture of my own shit. It's like that. Like
that
gives it. It also gives everybody else like an angle,
right?
Which I think everybody's begging for. Everybody in an improv scene, as a straight man, a person who's being initiated to, is like begging you to give them an angle. Right.
What world are we in?
Yeah. Like, because I think that that's when they have to do all that work to figure out what you want them to do. It gets so gnarly because it then you have to rely on them just inherently understanding where you're coming from, which is never going to happen. And that's how you end up with those scenes that are like you're initiating and then they don't realize what you said was weird and they start being weird and then you're both weird and neither of you decides on what the game is and you just are both weird characters doing nothing for 3.5 minutes.
And then you got two more beats of that.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, and that, and I think that that on Harold Knight, I found anytime I could like set up a, with my initiation, give my scene partner the thing that I need from them before I give them the game, right? Give them how to feel before I tell them why they feel that way. Like being like, I know you're all going to be like, you're going to think this is maybe a little bit unorthodox, okay? Because as you know, I am an avant-garde sculptor who doesn't just do the normal thing.
Right, right.
So I've prepared for this reaction, but I want you to know that at the end of the day, you're really going to end up loving this piece. You know what I mean? Like, you're telling them, like, you can tell your scene partner how to react to you.
Right, right.
Before you tell them what they're even reacting to. And I think that that's a thing that gets lost when your initiation is, oh, thank you for coming. Here's my weird thing.
Right, right, right.
Because then they have to sit there, take in that weird thing and be like, okay, that is crazy. Now, where are we? What are we doing? How do I move forward? I think that's how you end up in those scenes that are just like weird arguments.
Yeah.
Of just like, no, that what you're doing is weird. Like, and it's like, no, it's not. Yeah, no, but what you're doing is totally weird. Like, yeah, I know that you think it's weird, but it's not weird. It's actually really normal to me. Like, that scene sucks.
Right.
But like a scene of like highfalutin, like art people, like looking at this sculpture of a human shit, like, and all having those like sort of like human reactions, but like couched in that sort of high end art gallery atmosphere, I think gives you so much more to play with. And it's such an easier scene to do because everybody in that scene then knows who they are. And knows why then they would be reacting to the thing that they're reacting to the way that they are, right? Because right. they know that they are like rich people in an art gallery. It's like their reaction to a sculpture that's going to be shit. Either way, if they love it, that's funny because it's not funny. Again, this premise is not funny. This is a bad premise for a scene that I would note the premise itself if a team initiated it that I was coaching. I would say that's a bad premise.
Look, my friend... I'm almost close to giving you a pilot deal, okay? So you're talking to the wrong guy. I dig it.
But you know what I mean? Like the either reaction, a supportive or a sort of antagonistic reaction to that thing, knowing that you are a rich art sort of consumer, either way you choose to react to the thing, you know how to play it, right? Yeah. If you choose you hate it, you know why you hate it, because you think Monet and painters, other painters are better. I don't know any painters.
You knew Monet.
Yeah, Monet. He's the one, man. But you are, or if you love it, you know why, yeah, right? Yeah. Because you're like avant-garde. Like this is something I've never seen before. This is pushing boundaries. Like you give them something to latch onto so that their reaction can come from a place that's not just a vacuum, right? So I think that's, for me, that just goes down to that's my whole approach, I think, to improv. And it was what I tried to do on Harold Knight. And I still try to do to this day, like at Winslow's show on Friday nights, is like just give my scene partner enough to go off of early so that they're not ever in a place where they have to decide, like make a decision without any context.
Right.
But yeah.
So once like half the battle is done, you know, you initiate, you got that premise out there. Let's say we've even hit that first sort of like little beat of the game. I feel like one easy way to get then stuck is talking about the justification of that weird thing and not moving on to another game move. And it's something that took me a long time to sort of work on. And it's something you see a lot in auditions I've seen and a lot of, you know, just indie shows I've seen. Like, what way do you sort of use for yourself to sort of combat that a little bit?
I think it goes back to, like, I don't know who gave me the note first, but lose the argument. like if it comes down to arguing whether or not someone's justification is good enough, lose. Because it goes back to also the idea, like from like Ian Roberts, I took a workshop with him a while ago, and his whole thing is like pursue pleasure, avoid pain. And an argument is pain. No human being wants to, unless they're like insane, wants to sit in pain.
Right.
And if I'm arguing with someone about why they did something and they're telling me this is really the reason that I did this, I can absolutely choose to accept that and move on. Just lose. And I think that that's the thing that like I constantly give that note when I'm coaching, and I give that note to myself sometimes too. I still find myself in scenes where I'm like pushing for a better justification from someone where it's just like, no, that one's fine. Shut up. Like it's good enough for us to move on. And I think that it's just losing. It's saying, okay, that's how you feel. That's really how you feel. Then I don't agree with it, but I can't continue this interaction. We have other things that we need to do.
And then we just kind of go back to the base reality
and do what we're there. And that's the thing too. It's like when you set up that base reality, it gives you like those easy breaths. It gives you those easy moments to just be like, you know what? I'm done with this. Like to go back to our beautiful example of this art gallery. If somebody is just like, I don't want your painting. I don't want your painting. Like you can't make art out of poop. That's gross. And I am like, instead of being like, but no, I can. And I did. And you want this. It's like, they've decided they don't. Like, okay, you know what? Fine. I understand. Maybe this piece isn't for you, but there's so many other pieces here. Like here, have a look here. Like we go and we move to a new piece. It's like, you've given yourself the like sort of skeleton that you can hang the rest of the scene on. But if you've done none of that work, that's how you end up in those scenes that are just arguing over justification.
Right.
It's when nobody wants to do the work to set up a base reality. So the only thing you have is this disagreement about whether or not what someone did was crazy. And that is a recipe for disaster. Real, true disaster.
Absolute disaster.
Yeah, that's
the disaster of the worst awful kind. you know,
improv is very serious.
Improv is...
It can cause very big problems in the world.
It, you know what the big problem is? Not enough people do it. And not enough people are releasing their emotional and physical tensions through improv.
Physical tensions. Releasing physical tensions through improv.
That's what I do.
Yeah. Oh, no. I've seen you. Yeah. It's gross.
Yeah. I just... I'm constantly like play characters where like I'm humping the floor. I've gotten a lot of harsh notes recently. So let's say in second beats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, there's two kind of schools of thought. Some people will be like, well, you know, you still need to reset that, you know, that scene up a little bit, or you just kind of, the other thought is sort of just like, we already know this game, just run with it immediately. Like, how do you like to approach a second beat?
I think it's different depending on the idea, right? Like, I think some ideas, like, you're better suited giving yourself, like, a new set of specifics. And I think it's kind of down to, like, if you go analogous, you're going to have to do a little bit more of that work that you did in the first beat. If you time dash, like, you can kind of just hit the ground running. And I think it is all dependent on the idea, right? Like, for me, I think I personally prefer to time dash as an improviser, just because I think that like it's done less. Mm-hmm. I think if you go to Harold Knight these days, it seems like a lot of second beats are analogous, or they're like sort of like world building second beats, which I also think is great.
Mm-hmm.
But I think doing a good time dash is hard and cool if you can do it, because like you're essentially just saying like, hey, all that other shit is still true, and here's three more beats that are even crazier than that.
How do you avoid for yourself plot, like ever kind of getting to the realm of plot?
I think it's like damage. I think it's context. Like, don't go to the place that you would expect to go as that character, right? Like if it's in that. Going back to this stupid example of this guy who makes like shitty art, literally.
Oh yeah, the pilot is coming.
It's called shitty art. But like in that example, Like if it's like you sold that painting or that sculpture, right? Like a second, like there are tons of different options for like second beat. There's like the plot version of that. That's just this like shit art salesman who's, I can't believe I'm running with this example.
But he's not a shit art salesman. He makes this
sucks.
Shit, right?
Yes, this sucks. I'm sorry. But like there's the plot thing that I think a lot of people, it's like the sort of like ripcord safety, mm-hmm. like of like, oh, I don't have an idea. So now this guy is now destitute because nobody wants to buy his shitty art. It's like, that's not funny.
Right.
Right. But like for me, like I would consider like a time dash of that idea, like somebody in that art gallery bought that piece, mm-hmm. right? It's now in their home and like their kid is seeing it for the first time. You know what I mean? Like that's like, it's a new setting. It's a new like set of specifics in that you can have now a like new perspective. What happens? Does this kid like fucking like love this art and like roll around on the ground with it? I don't know. That's, again, this is a bad example. But I think like for me, it's just like, it's like, don't be scared of trying a time dash in this case, time dash, because I think that that's like, people get scared of doing like a second beat. So they rely on just like, well, what's the easiest thing for me to do right now? And it's just like, what could be next for that guy? It's not about what could be next for that guy. It's about how can I continue to play the funny idea of this game, right?
Sure.
And then, again, maybe it's that kid sees this art and is inspired, and now that kid is a shit artist. You know what I mean? It's like shit art becomes like all the rage in like this kid's school or whatever. He takes his painting. He gets a note from his teacher that says, like, your parents have to come in for a teacher conference because you've been making all of your paintings out of shit. Like, it's like, what are the consequences? I think that consequences come into play in Time Dash, which I think is a really fun idea of like, what does that mean for the world? And what are the consequences of your choice to sort of pursue that weird thing?
So for you, that would be like, let's say blowing out the world.
Yeah. I think that, and that is something that I think as like on Winslow, we were pretty good at when we were on Herald Night, our second beats, when we did good second beats, would be like more like world building, where it would be very like super supportive and a lot of like seeing what the consequences of the choices in that first beat meant. And I think that, I guess that all kind of does tie into like, that's just a time dash. Like world building, I think is a time dash in its own,
right,
in
right.
its own weird way. But yeah, I think that's usually my first thought, unless it's like something that's like very obviously like, especially if you're in your first beat, my first beat is like something that's sort of pulling on an analogy in some way, I'll probably go for an analogous second beat as well. But usually I'm like, time dash all the way, bro.
All the way, baby. Definitely for me, it's challenging.
Yeah.
I've been working on it more, but like I could see the also the fun and the merits of it too. Mm-hmm. And I guess the best thing is just to become good at both and then just decide what you want to do.
Not to flip it back on you, but what do you think is hard about a time dash?
I guess time dash for me is figuring out where else can we sort of move this, where else can we put these people where we can play this game in an easy manner, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very general thing. But, like, I guess the difficulty for me, especially back in days, lied in how do I play this game again without turning it into a continuation of the story, mm-hmm. it's more the continuation of the game, mm-hmm. rather than the continuation of the story. So like that was sort of the difficult part for me.
Yeah. Do you think that that is something that made you like be like, I don't want to even try those? I don't even want to try time dashes because I'm scared that it'll turn into this?
In the beginning, yeah. Before I got sort of like forced myself into doing different ways. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But now, even though going analogous is my natural instinct, is my first thought is that, but like time, I find myself doing more time dashes in Herald Night, mm-hmm. because if a character is really fun, I kind of want to, and the character is doing that game, I kind of want to follow that character with his game rather mm-hmm. than just take that game. And then, you know, maybe like we blow out that world in the, you know, in second beats with that character.
Yeah. Right? And I think another thing, just sort of thinking about this, when you're like dealing with like a fun character like that, I think that like, I think the thing that I would say people need to avoid in like a time dash second beat is dealing with anything that's not relevant to the game.
Right.
I think that's when it becomes story. Right, that's when it becomes plot, is when it's like that character's just doing something else now and it's not at all related to the game. And I think that happens all the time, where it's like in the first thing, in the first beat, like somebody gets a divorce, and then the second beat they're like with their divorce lawyer, and it's like there's it just feels cheap.
That's a Lifetime movie.
And yeah, exactly. And it's this shit artist. but I think that what was I going to say? I was going to say, I think for me, I forgot what I was going to say, so never mind. I think for me, nothing. I'm done.
Nice.
I think for me, that was a statement. It wasn't the start of
that's
a
thought. That's great, and I think that's a lesson to anybody, that it's like, don't think for other people, think for you. Man, thank you, my brother. Hey. Appreciate that. A mistake turned into something that...
Real life advice.
You know.
Take that.
So here's a super specific one, but this is something that like I've been working on recently. And in second, so the first beat, let's say it's a classic unusual person voice of reason. In the second beat, how necessary is that voice of reason? And do you ever like for you? Does it kind of need to sort of mirror a little bit that dynamic, or couldn't it just be a more sort of like again like blowing out that world in terms of like then you would just play with. Like all the support moves then are just literally playing that unusual game themselves.
I kind of think second beats should always be playing justification to me. And if it's been justified, I don't think you need anybody to talk about it anymore. Right. I don't think we need to talk about it. I don't think unless you are going like analogous and you need a new justification to adjust like justify a similar behavior, like I don't think you need it, man. Like, and I think that like that comes down to what was fun, like what was the most fun part of the first beat. It definitely wasn't somebody asking like leading questions to try to get a justification out of like the unusual person, right. So I think that it's like more about just being like, okay, well, what do we have the most fun doing in the first beat? Like, what was the most fun part of that game? Was it inventing the funny ways in which shit was used to make art? Mm. Or was it the like art patrons talking about how this shit was a travesty? Mm. It's like, that's not going to be the fun part of it. Also, the first part isn't fun because this is a bad example of an improv scene. But you know what I mean? It's like taking the most fun part of that first beat and giving yourself as much of an opportunity to play it as you possibly can. And like using as little of your sort of scene real estate to like do things that aren't fun as you can. Because ideally, your first beat's 3.5 minutes, your second beat is 2, right? You want them to go faster. Right. So you need to just kind of jump into it. But that said, I think it happens constantly. Like I still see it like when I go to Herald Night, like where you have like the second beats that are still just kind of an argument. And yeah. I think that like if you get yourself into the headspace of just like looking at your first beat as like inspiration for the second beat, instead of like, well, we have to have the same roles, we have to have the same sort of approach in our second beat. It's like, no, like what was fun in the first beat? I mean, it maybe isn't exactly how it's phrased in like the UCB curriculum or anything like that, but I think that's the intent. It's like about pulling what's fun and what's funny out of that first beat and playing that in your second beat, instead of playing this sort of one-to-one comparison of like, if you lay those scenes over each other, they shouldn't look anything alike, in my opinion. They should be completely different. And I think that comes down to like whether it's everybody saying yes to the world in your second beat, or this guy meeting someone who has a similar view to him and them sort of like expanding on the universe themselves or whatever. I think it's just making sure that your second beat is just taking whatever was fun in that first beat, playing it even harder, playing it even faster, playing it even like broader in scope, like figuring out the scope, right? Mm-hmm. And then moving into that territory. I think that's sort of how I would approach a second beat. I typically try to not. If I straight man somebody in a first beat, I try to find a way to play not as a straight man.
Like, play that game with
him. Yeah, play the game with him. Even if I'm not a person who believes they're right, I'm still a person who believes that what they think is right is happening. You know what I mean? Like, you have to, like, let it happen, kind of, in a second beat in particular, I think.
What about situations where I'm sure, you know, we've all been in them, where it's like, you get out of the first beat and you're like, I kind of don't know what the fucking game is. I know what the funny things were. I know what the unusual thing is, but I really don't know what the game is, and we didn't have a justification. But you got a second beat coming. Mm-hmm. So, like, what, in your experience that's happened to you, like, what are ways you feel like...
happens constantly.
It's like something it just happens. Yeah. Like, there's no science to all this, you know? It's just sometimes...
That's what I'm saying. We all have a batting average. Some of our batting averages are 400. Some of our batting averages are higher. Some of our batting averages are lower. And in the instances where in your first scene, you strike out or you know, get an infield fly, whatever, like, you do... I mean, you have to kind of forget about it. Mm. And I think that for me, it kind of has always been... trying to distill the first beat into the fun. What was the most fun to do? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like I think it was Charlie Sanders. He was my 401 teacher, and I remember doing a scene that it was a first beat in Harold, and it didn't go well. We initiated a second beat. I can't remember who I was in it with, but it doesn't matter. We initiated the second beat and just kind of did like we like rehashed the first beat to try to like fix it. And I remember him giving us the note of just like, you're not going to be able to fix your first scene and your second scene. Mm. If your first scene is like a bust, you have to go into your second scene and just cut away all the bullshit and try to make the second beat redeem the first beat by being good. Mm-hmm, right. Which I think is like, what it boils down to is just like thinking to yourself, okay, in that first scene, what was fun? What was successful? What did the audience like? What did I like doing? And now how can I go into the second beat and make it so that's the thing that we're doing instead of all the other unnecessary bullshit that didn't really work? So it's like, if in the first beat of this fucking shit artist thing, the thing that's the most fun is like all these like people bidding on this art. You know, whatever the scene is, who knows? If it's all these people bidding on this art and wanting it in their house for different, disgusting, weird, stupid reasons, if that's the thing we're having fun with, like, let's play with something that's more about that in our second beat. Like, let's pull, instead of just being like a person who makes art out of something weird, like, let's do something that's like if the thing that's fun is all these people like are like obsessed with shit, like. And let's do like fucking Eyes Wide Shut, where like all these people are in like a weird secret cult that like loves shit or something. You know what I mean? This is such a bad example.
It's an example we consistently went back to.
And at this point, I'm going to keep going back to it because
we don't have another example.
Yeah, I don't have another example, and we can't go and like retcon everything.
Also a good example because it's like it's a little on the nose, so it will help, like, let's say students that are just getting into like game and like 301 and stuff, maybe like
it's very broad hack example, which is my sense of humor, like broad bad, like not funny, but no, you know, I do think I agree with you, it is like such an extreme example that it kind of makes it easy to illustrate, but like it's just the idea of like for me never going into a second beat with that attitude of just like, oh, here we go,
right.
Like using that time on the back line to be like, okay, but what was fun in the first beat? Mm-hmm. There had to be something fun. Let's cut away all the other bullshit and go into our second beat with just that kernel of like, this is what was fun. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. Because I think like trying to like redeem yourself by like fixing that scene in your second beat, I think it comes down to like the one of those things where like, because the Harold Knight audience is so heavily students, everybody kind of feels it. They feel that you're trying to like sort of like retroactively fix your first beat. And they're just like, y'all's first beat sucked. And we all know that you think that now because this scene is this way. You know what I mean?
And it's the worst thing is when they're saying it out loud.
Yeah, it's in the audience. Can't tell you how many times that happened.
Rings the
Winslow and Harold
energy completely down.
But you know what I mean? Like it's like go into that scene, which is like, okay, yeah, that first beat sucked. Mm-hmm. But this second beat, we're going to have fun with the thing that we had fun with in the first beat, even if the rest of that scene was trash. Like, let's throw it away and fucking play with that, like, nasty apple core that was in the trash instead of trying to play with that whole trash bin. You know what I mean? Right. Ooh, weird analogy.
But I like it. There's a lot of dirty analogies, but they all make
sense nasty.
To me.
I'm nasty. You know that.
And then, yeah. And then when I keep calling you nasty, boy, you're like, why are you calling me that?
Like, well, now it's all making sense. Nasty now that boy. I'm hearing it out loud, I'm a nasty boy.
So, like support, you know, I feel like when, especially when you're first getting into improv, like, and you're learning the Herald, it's like, it's so important to be in one of those core scenes, or it's so important to be able to, like, be out, it feels important to be out there and kind of do your thing. But, like, me personally, one thing I always appreciated is people's support moves, like, sort of the people who are like ninjas and like would just, and I always thought, like, you're able to do both. You're able to, you do, you know, great scene work and then you're a great support player. For you, what do you think makes a good support player?
I think it's
a broad question.
Yeah, no. I appreciate the question. I think it for me, that was kind of in my sort of evolution as a performer. And performing with people who are much more like confidently confident and bold in the choices they make in scenes, I think it sort of allowed me to step back and develop that muscle. And I think to me, what it takes to me is just like noticing when there's an opportunity to clarify, right? And like, I think that's all support moves should clarify the game if it feels like it's on the sort of fence where like both people are kind of like, what's the game here? If you on the back line are like, I know what the game is, let me help you play it, like that's the first thing for me. And secondly, it's like I think and this is maybe me projecting, but I think when you're in a scene, sometimes it can be hard to think of like the next logical heighten.
Oh, definitely.
Where you like, you want to heighten, but you don't know what the best path is. And I think for me as an outsider, I have a good brain for heightening. Mm-hmm. Not to toot my own horn, but like I think that I have a brain that can sort of linearly heighten in a very like organic way.
Quick, efficient way.
But I find that in scenes, when I'm in a scene, sometimes I will jump, I'll jump a step. I'll go too slowly. You know what I mean? And I think when I'm playing on the back line, I'm watching completely objectively to be like, okay, they just made this move. Is there a move that I can see as an objective observer that heightens like clearly in a direction that maybe they won't see because they are in it, you know what I mean? And I think a lot of it is me projecting other people. I think there are other people who are very good in a scene about thinking ahead while they're in the moment. But I think that's the sort of impulse for me on the back line, is always like if it feels like we're itching for a game move, using that part of my brain that is just listening to the scene and objectively observing it to sort of like formulate that move, right? I think that's a thing that like you have the luxury of when you're on the back line, like you can think about your move a little bit, and like you can think about what's the best way to do it. And sometimes that thought, the moment passes, and you know, UCB does not want you to think. I'm kidding. That is a bad joke.
I'm leaving.
Yeah. Pete, no, he's gone.
So funny. I did that same beat in the last one where I left and then. I hope the audience will like it because I did it a lot.
But you know what I mean? It's like, I think for me, I appreciate the moment to think. And I think that that's like a thing that I also bring into improv. I've like developed weird little tricks for myself in scenes to allow myself to have those moments within the scene. And usually, like, you can ask any team that I coach, it's like emotional reaction. Like in a scene, I'll start crying. Like if I'm sad in a scene, the game is eliciting like sadness, I'll literally just start crying and give myself 2 seconds to just think about like what I want to do next. Right. Or like, I'll like storm away like in a huff or just like scream, I can't believe this, and just give myself that like big punch in the scene to pause it kind of, right? Like where it's like, we know we need to move, but we don't know what the best way is to right now. But what I do know is this is how I'm feeling. And an easy way for me to buy myself some time is to feel that more.
It's like a time to think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think emotion is a huge thing. I could do a whole a whole podcast just about playing emotionally, because I think that's a huge part of me as a performer as well. But I think like that gets lost a lot, especially to people who are just learning how to do like UCB style improv, because it is so like sort of logic based and like, mm-hmm. and sort of like brain based in terms of like the, like getting these rules in your head. You forget that like sometimes just being a human being is enough in a scene, and like being emotional and being able to buy yourself that time to do those little, the little work, to do the like flash memory exercise for me and Robert's workshop that he does. I don't know if you've ever done it. Great exercise.
I've heard all about it. Like,
it's an amazing exercise. Yeah, it's my favorite exercise. I do it with every group I coach. But like, you get, if you can give yourself that moment in a scene to do that, if you've not gotten to the place where you can do it in a snap, like I think he can and a lot of other people can, I can't. I need to give myself that moment because my brain doesn't work as fast as a lot of other people's.
And then just to clarify a little bit, so that for the flashing exercise, can we clarify for...
Yeah, so it's like the idea is, the way it works as an exercise is two people sort of sit facing each other. Someone makes a statement, an initiation, a neutral initiation. Like, I bought myself a new IKEA shelf today. And then the person who receives that information has a moment where their memory flashes. Like, they have a flash memory that is some sort of visual experience that sort of flashes into their brain that is sort of created by that information, right? And then that person sort of takes in that image and tries to encapsulate the information from that image in their response to sort of create this sort of shared mind where we're drawing from things that are true to us to create a world that's true to us. And I think like the way that in practice in a scene, I sort of use that is I will emotionally react and then I'll think, what does this scene make me think of? Like, what does this make me feel? What from my real life has inspired this kind of emotion, and how can I use that in the scene? And I just buy myself time by crying.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. In every scene. I cry a lot. Come watch Winslow on Friday nights and you'll probably see me cry straight up. I cry probably every show.
I noticed, and the audience was really down. The audience was really sad.
Yeah. I got a lot of like pats on the back and like sort of like sweet moments from audience members. Nice. Like, they all really, like, are you okay? And I'm always just like, no. Because
everything will be okay.
I'm actually very good. I'm very happy.
You're very happy. You're always in a good. You always got good energy. That's why I love you, my buddy. So, before we wrap up,
yes,
I guess like, what would you say? What would be like an advice you can give to students, people like when it comes to like, let's say they got to a point where they're struggling, maybe they're not having so much fun with learning the concepts, and they're like, when can I get, on the level of a John Mackey? And, when can I get on the level where I'll be on the Herald team? Or, like, what would be, like, advice do you say to somebody that's kind of going through an improv funk?
I think that there are a ton of people who get improv enough to be on a Herald team, or whatever, like they get it enough. They are good improvisers, but the thing that they're missing is the ability to relax, right? I think we as human beings understand game. Game is like human conversation. It's not. It's obviously articulated in a much more like interesting way throughout the curriculum, et cetera. But like, to me, I think game is literally just conversation. It's the natural patterns we pick up on. And the thing that's preventing a lot of people who are good enough improvisers to be on the level with other, like with the people they consider better than them, mm-hmm. is the ability to relax and let themselves come out. Let their individual voice sort of be the driving force behind their improv instead of the rules, right? It's like you've learned the rules enough. You know the rules. Now you have to let you drive the car instead of letting improv drive its own car, right? And I think that that's the thing that I push for. When I coach people or like see people improvise and they ask me like advice, it's always to me, it's like just relax. Like, you have to relax. And, like, if you know the rules, if you know how to do improv, the only way to get better is to let yourself get better. And I think the thing that prevents you from getting better is thinking about every little thing and turning yourself into this, like, machine that's like, I know the rules, I'm going to do the rules. Instead of being like, I know the rules, I'm going to go do
the scene.
John Mackey's going to go do improv, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we all have our very own specific voice. And I think that's the thing that's so beautiful about UCB is that you go on stage and when I see Peter Banifaz perform, it's not going to look anything like when John Mackey performs. And when John Mackey tries to perform like Peter Banifaz, he fails. And when Peter Banifaz tries to perform like John Mackey,
they throw him out of the building.
They throw him out of the building. They light him on fire and throw him out of the building and say, you can never come back here.
Yeah, like full-blown assault, felony assault.
Yeah, and I think the thing, the kernel of advice I'd give people is forget what you think is what you, the image of good that you think about. Forget the, like, the performer on the pedestal that you're thinking, I have to be like them someday.
Right.
Like, I gotta be them. That's constantly, it's gonna keep you in a place where you are thinking too hard about improv and not thinking about how to bring yourself to the work you're doing. So I think 9 times out of 10, if you can sort of break somebody out of that cycle of like obsessing about the form and put them into a position where they're thinking like, I get the form, I know it, now let me do it. Like, that's 9 times out of 10, I think gonna like completely elevate the performer.
Gotcha.
And I think the only way to do that is to, yeah, just like know that you know it well enough. And like the next step is to just like do what you think is funny.
Spoken like a true artist, gentleman, and a teacher.
What kind of artist?
A true artist.
But is it, what does this artist make his stuff out of?
A poo artist. A true poo artist. Ladies and gentlemen, John Mackey.
Thank you so much.
Such
Pete, that was really fun. You're a doll baby.
You're a doll baby. And I've personally learned so much from you. You've coached me, and I always enjoy watching you. How can our listeners check you out?
You can follow me on Twitter at It's John Mackey. On Twitter, you can also follow my sketch and improv group at Big Grande UCB on Twitter. I'll plug it. We've got a podcast called The Teacher's Lounge that you can listen to on Stitcher Premium. No offense to the UCB Podcast Network.
No, there's room for all of us, right?
First season of that is on iTunes as well for free.
Absolutely fucking hilarious.
And you can see Winslow every Friday night at 9:30 paired with the soundtrack at UCB Franklin out here in L.A. And if you want to come to a show, if you're visiting, just hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and we can probably get you a comp if they're available. That's a very like easy thing to guarantee. If comps are available or we have tickets to give away, we can try to give you one.
Nice.
But yeah, that's it.
Awesome. Thank you so much,
beautiful.
My man.
Peter.
Beautiful. You're a beautiful man.
Beautiful.
Love it.
Beautiful.
And that was Long Form Conversation. Tune into the next episode when John Mackey will be your host. Thank you so much. This is Peter Banifaz saying goodbye and good luck.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at ucbtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.